I'll start off with a little bit of a story on me. No one gives an introduction like Don. You know that already. So 2012, I was still at Bumby in Orlando, but came over for lectures. You know, lectures when you're not in Tampa is really something. Lectures when you're in Tampa is like, well, okay, I'll make one if I can. But living in Orlando, came over for the week and came for the singing that Wednesday evening. Well, I was sitting right about there. Brother Harold, Ed Harold, was sitting on the end of the pew with his wonderful wife, and Brother Sewell Hall and Sister Kenita Hall were sitting about right there. Well, Don makes his way up the aisle, and I'm thinking, okay, he's going to talk to Brother Harold, he's going to talk to Brother Sewell, he's going to have them do something. He says, Josh, would you lead our opening prayer? I said, okay. Now, pride's an issue with everybody. We understand that. But yes, the heads start swelling. And so I go up to the front, and Don makes it seem like I am the COC version of Billy Graham. I am the greatest thing that's ever happened in the body of a young 30 preacher. So I get up there and lead the prayer, and that all goes fine. I go back to sit down. I'm feeling pretty good about myself. My oldest son, who's 12 now, was, I'm going to say 2012, so about two, going on, he's about three. We had been feeding him almonds and not paying attention to the fact that he was not swallowing any of the almonds. He is just grinding up almonds in his mouth to the point where he just has a mouthful of almond dust. Coughing fit commences. Almond dust is spewing all over Brother Harold, Sister Harold, I think some got on the halls as well. And off goes this wonderful young preacher screaming through the back with a two-year-old spewing almonds. And that's when you're reminded not to think too highly of yourself. Well, a cruel joke was played on me tonight. I was told that my topic was John's use of the Antichrist in 1 John. That's apparently not what we're discussing tonight. So go ahead and turn your Bibles to 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel 17. That is going to be our main text this evening. We are going to go to a New Testament passage later on as well. 1 Samuel 17 is, of course, where our encounter takes place. Tonight's lesson is all about fear. 1 Samuel 17 is a chapter about fear. It's about how two different groups handle that fear. When we read an occasion like this, when we think of David and we see David in the story, we may be tempted to think that David just did not experience fear. If you've read the Psalms, though, you know that's not true. When you read the Psalms, you see that David constantly had fear in his life. As an example, Psalm 55, and in verse 4, David offers this lament to his God. My heart is in anguish within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. Behold, I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness. David was not immune to fear. And the encounter that we have in 1 Samuel 17 is one that would make anyone afraid. The question is, what do you do when you encounter something that makes you afraid? And that is where David is differentiated from everybody else in the story. Let's just do a little bit of background, though, as we're looking here. See if I can get that one to work. Okay, there we are. Let's talk about the Philistines first. Of course, certainly they have a major role in the story. Now, the Philistines, for us, as we study the Old Testament, we understand they're kind of a constant nuisance oftentimes to Israel. In fact, they invaded the coastland in about 1200 BC. And the first encounter, at least prolonged encounter that we have with them, is, of course, in the days of Samson, the judge. And really, throughout Samson's 20 years judging over Israel, the Philistines are that force which is opposed to God's people. Of course, there are encounters with the Philistines in the days of Eli. We know the well-known story of the Philistines capturing the ark during the days of Eli, and Eli dies. During the days of Samuel, in fact, Samuel leads Israel to victory over the Philistines once. In the early days of Saul, he has victories over the Philistines. But when we come to chapter 17, something monumental has happened in the reign of Saul. And that is, of course, that he has now been rejected as king. And perhaps the two coincide. Saul is rejected as king. And you start reading in chapter 17 and in verse 1 that the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. And they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Socoh and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. The map there has some of the routes that would have been taken. The area we're looking at, well, try that one more time. Nope, nope, that was too far. There we are. Thank you. In the Valley of Elah. And where the picture, where Brother Jenkins took this picture from, you would have been standing where the Israelite forces were gathered. And you're looking out across the valley, and that is where the Philistine forces would have been gathered. The text goes on to say that this is not just a normal army. Yes, the Philistine forces are there, but one champion comes out from the midst of the Philistine forces, Goliath of Gath. And it speaks of him that he's 9 feet 9 inches tall. His armor weighs 125 pounds. The head of his spear weighs 15 pounds. I engage in an activity where weight is everything. And I don't mean necessarily just my weight, although it helps if you can get some weight off. I ride a bike for exercise. I rode this morning. And everything about that is getting as little weight as possible on that bicycle. So you could go to Walmart and you could buy, for instance, a bottle cage for a bicycle. You know, just something to be able to put a water bottle in. That may cost you $5. The cages on my bicycle cost about $25. Why? Because they're about 2 ounces lighter than the ones you'd buy at Walmart. Weight's everything. Not for this guy. In fact, it was seen that the heavier, the better. The thicker the armor, and it does not matter to him. He can march, he can fight wearing 125 pounds. It's no big deal. But what we read of our text, what's so important in our text, is what he says. Verse 8 of chapter 17. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine? And you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you should become our servants and serve us." Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Was referred to as the Battle of Champions. Whereas instead of two armies battling and slaying each other, one representative from either side. Goliath says, with all the assurance in the world, "I'll represent the Philistines. You find your champion. You send them out. We'll battle. And the victor of that battle wins it all." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. You skip down to verse 16. You see that the story is even worse. Because for a period of 40 days, Goliath comes out, and again, just picture. Here you're standing and you're looking out across that valley. You can see the Philistine forces on the other hill. And there's that one, taller, bigger, stronger than the rest. And he comes forward twice a day, every day, and issues the same challenge, send your man. We will battle. Skipping ahead in the story just a little bit, on one occasion when that happens, verse 24, when all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. Israel is dominated by fear. And what's significant in the story as well, God is never mentioned. No one in Israel even mentions that we have a giant too, Jehovah God. Well, you and I, though, we know this story. We know who the hero is. We know the one who puts his faith and his trust in God and the one who's going to be victorious over this giant. But the interesting thing I find in chapter 17 is while we know this about David, nobody in 1 Samuel 17 thought David was going to do anything. Starts with his father. Beginning in verse 20, verse 17, it talks about how David and David was, you know, working for his father. David's older brothers had gone to fight with Saul. Now, armies didn't normally battle for 40 days. In this time, you go out, you fight, and you go back home. You don't have the supplies and the means of transporting those supplies to engage in a conflict for 40 days. So this plays a factor in our story, and I realize I'm already behind in our presentation here. So that was the first point. We talked about fear a little bit. Give that one more whirl. No, that's not working. Just advance that for me if you would. We don't actually have to have the PowerPoint. We can go without it. All right. So here is David at his father's home. And his father is going to send David to the battlefield, but to do this. Verse 17, then Jesse said to David, his son, take now for your brothers an ephah, this roasted grain and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000, and look into the welfare of your brothers, and bring back news of them. Jesse already knows that David is the next anointed king of Israel. Which that's a whole other story about maybe doubt of David. You recall, of course, in chapter 16, when Samuel had gone to Jesse's home to anoint the next king, all of the brothers were there except David. He was left out. He's off with the sheep. And then he's anointed to be the next king. Well, now Jesse knows this, but he's going to send David, but to be a courier, to be a messenger. David, take these supplies and then bring back news. But there is no thought that David can do anything to help in the battle or even to end the battle. No, just take the supplies and bring back news. David gets there. He starts to hear. In fact, he's present when Goliath comes out and issues this challenge. And he looks around, he sees all the fear, and so he begins to ask questions. What's all this about? And people are telling him, you know, Saul has pledged all these wonderful things to the person who will go out and fight this giant. David's oldest brother, Eliab, verse 28, hears this. Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle. Now, I've got two boys, and I understand the older brother generally gives the younger brother a pretty hard time, and maybe David had done some things to deserve that over the years. But you see in that Eliab has no faith and confidence in David. Why are you here? Did you hope you could come and see a show? There'd be a gory bloodbath going on and you could see this and you'd have something to go home and tell your friends about? Is that why you're here? Word comes to Saul. Now, think of Saul. And think from it from this standpoint, the embarrassment that Saul must be going through. By the way, Saul's afraid. We already read that. For 40 days, the Philistine champion has come out and said, come on, if you've got anybody with enough guts to come out here and fight, send him out here. And not a man in Saul's army says, I'll do it. Imagine the embarrassment to Saul. He is a king. And he doesn't have a subject. He does not have a warrior in his army that says, I'll go 40 days. And lo and behold, here's David. And David says, I'll go. You remember Saul's response to David. Verse 33, Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. For you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or bear came and took a lamb from the flock. And we'll come back to that in just a little bit. What is Saul's thinking? You're no match. This giant will eat you for breakfast. Well, of course, we fast forward in the story. We know David does go out to face the giant. And then we even see the disdain of Goliath. Verse 43, the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his God. There is no one in this story that believes in David. There is only doubt. The Philistines are stronger than us. We can't ever get rid of them. Every time we're successful in battle against them, they keep on coming back. And now they've come with a giant. And so all of Israel is afraid, and they cast that fear onto David. They doubt him, and they want David to doubt himself as well. Well, of course, we understand about David's courage. Try that one more time. Nope. There we are. And the reason for his courage is his trust in the Lord. Go back to verse 26, and there's something interesting here. When Goliath had first issued his challenge, he defied the servants of Saul. As I mentioned to you earlier, nobody in the story even mentions the Lord. But when David hears Goliath's taunts, David responds in verse 26, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? David's the only one in the story that mentions God. He's the only one in the story that knows that God fights for his people. Goliath thinks he's fighting the army of Saul, the servants of Saul. And the servants of Saul must have been thinking the same thing. We fight for Saul, and Saul's afraid, so we're afraid. David says, this is the army of the living God. And of course, that courage was bred by past experiences. When Saul questioned David and saying, you know, you can't go and fight. And that's when there's a little section we already read where David then takes Saul back to his own earlier life. And says, when I was out in the field and a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, and I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David goes on to say in verse 37, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. His courage is from what God has done and how God has been with him in the past. But you know what? That courage had to act. I already sung the song about how David took up those five smooth stones. And by the way, please, I am begging you. If you have a question for me tonight, please do not ask me why five stones. We're going to follow that in the unknowable questions that are asked of preachers and teachers all the time that we don't have the answer for you. Maybe one day God will give us that answer. I don't know. But David went to this, now in that picture, dried up brook, gathered the five stones, and stood there. Do you think David was afraid? There's no mention of it in the text, but again, given what we understand of David in other passages, and he knows what fear is, I have no problem seeing David, small little David, compared to this giant, and there not being at least a wave of fear, the emotion that comes to David. But that's when David keeps going back. My God is with me. The Lord is fighting on my side. And that's what propels him to act. He has to stand there to meet the giant's charge. He has to put the rock in the sling and hurl the sling with all of his might, all the while trusting that God is going to do what he believes God will do, and that is protect his people and be with his anointed one. His courage came from his faith in God, and his courage acted. I'm not going to worry about the PowerPoint from here. You can blank it if you wish to, or we can just keep it right there. But I do want to talk to us for a few minutes. I invite you to turn over in your New Testaments to Matthew chapter 10. Passage where our Lord spoke about fear at some length. Because fear is a problem for God's people still. In this setting, Jesus is speaking to his closest disciples. And he has already told them, beginning in verse 24, that since people hated him and were accusing him of all kinds of things, they're going to be doing the same thing to his disciples. And that's when he says, beginning in verse 26, therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing concealed that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the darkness, speak in the light, and what you hear whispered in your ear, proclaim upon the housetops. Do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul. Rather, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a cent, and yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So do not fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. Our Lord's concern, as he goes on to talk about in verse 32, was that if his disciples were afraid of what man could and would do to them, then they would not confess him. They would not repeat the instructions and the words that Jesus had given to them, that message that needed to go out to the rest of the world. They would deny him instead. They would give in to fear. And so Jesus says, don't fear them. Fear inhibits. Fear keeps us from acting. You go back to the story of David, and it's bad enough that Israel, in their fear, would not act. Not a one. Jonathan included. There are some good people in this army. And not a one of them went out and met Goliath. So that's bad enough. But the tragedy of the story in 1 Samuel 17 is that everybody, in their fear, because they're not acting, they then want to cast that fear on David. David, we're afraid. You should be afraid too. We're not acting. You don't need to try and act. And that's what I want you to consider this evening. It's getting awfully dark outside. Awfully dark. You know, the Philistines kept on coming at the Israelites in various ways. Read in 1 Samuel 13 that at one time, there was not a blacksmith to be found in Israel. You had to go to the Philistines. So they had to somehow achieve that. And now in 1 Samuel 17, again, they come in a completely different way. They've got a giant. They kept on adapting. They kept on coming at Israel in different ways. Do you see Satan's doing the same thing? Keeps coming in different ways, and it's just getting darker and darker outside, and we're getting more afraid all the time. Challenges that we used to think about. You know, what would our college students, our young people, when they go off to college, what will they be exposed to? You know, what kind of teaching will they be exposed to that would seek to take away their faith in God? That was a significant challenge, still is a significant challenge. Challenge of alcohol and drugs has been prevalent for so long, still a challenge. You know, when I was a high schooler, the internet wasn't a thing. I mean, I think it existed, but we got AOL when I was a senior in high school, and I can remember, you know, the wonderful sound of that dialing up. Internet pornography was not a thing. Not a challenge my parents ever thought about. Is there a parent here that isn't constantly worried about what that will be like for their kids? I mentioned my oldest son's 12. He just finished his first year in middle school. I've had discussions with him my dad never even thought about having with me. And it just keeps getting darker. Now, not only is Christian morality mocked in the world, the very sense and notion that there would be such a thing as gender is mocked. And you are canceled if you were to say that there is such a thing as gender. These are the things that we see and we pay attention to, and we become afraid. We're afraid for that next generation. We're afraid of what this is going to do to them. And I understand that. I've got kids. I'm concerned. What we must not do, though, is put doubt in their minds. Let's not act as if things are so bad and we are so afraid that what we're doing then to our kids is you need to be afraid. Because this is how bad it is. No, we tell them about the God that's on their side. And we equip them with His armor. And we send them out and we say, God who is with David, and God who defeated Goliath with David, God's still with you. The giants have changed, but God is the same. Fear inhibits. Fear keeps us from doing anything. But if we'll think about God being on our side, going back to chapter 10 here, Matthew, notice how Jesus puts that. And there's this, you know, little section here that's interesting, the contrast. When Jesus says in verse 28, do not fear those who kill the body but are unable to kill the soul. Rather, fear Him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And on the surface, of course, we think, okay, yes, there is this fear we must have of God, which is true. But also think of it this way. What's Jesus saying to His disciples? Not just, okay, you better be faithful to God, because if you're not faithful to God, the consequences are worse. He's also saying to them, this God who can destroy both body and soul in hell is the God that's on your side. He has more power than the world. You're fearful of the world, but the God that's on your side is stronger than them. And that's why he continues on in the next verse, are not two sparrows sold for a cent? And yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. Very hairs of your head are all numbered. So do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows. That's the source of courage we have. That's the source of courage we've got to instill in our kids. And when they have that kind of courage, then they can act. How do they act? Do what Jesus says. Confess Him. Stand for what He stands for. And even, as he continues on in verses 37 through 39, when he speaks of, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it. And he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. How do we act in this courage? We place him first and foremost. And if we reach the day where, yes, we are actually taking up the cross, yes, we are actually losing our lives for his sake, then we're still victorious. We're still on the winning side. What time are they dismissing back in, Jonathan, in just a minute? Oh, not till 8? Are you kidding me? I got 15 more minutes, and you guys are in bad shape. Well, I could. All right, man, we're not going to make it all the way to 8 o'clock. But I want to end with this. I really thought I was going to like 7:50. My bad, guys. When the kids come out, chances are, some of them may know this, others won't. But you can ask all those kids, tell me about David. And those kids that were so excited up here, by the way, when Don gets really full of himself, tell him that, you know, my neighbors, right there, the Nerlands, their kids are much more excited for the garbage man every week, every single week. So they do love this, but I mean, if you were a garbage man, that would be exciting. But ask them about David. And man, they're going to be able to tell you about David. They're going to be able to tell you about this wonderful thing and this wonderful story and how David slew the giant. How great. Then ask them, tell me about Eliab. The teenage class may remember, if they read that part of the text, Eliab. Oh yeah, that's David's brother. The little ones never heard of him. If he was mentioned, that went out the window a long time ago. They don't have a clue. They tell me about Eliab. And they're like, who? You know, I don't know that Eliab was a bad guy. He may have been great. I would like to think that, you know, he's a pretty decent guy. He's, after all, he's the son of Jesse too. And I'd like to think that, you know, Jesse and the way that he raised David helped contribute to him being a man after God's own heart. So maybe Eliab had some of those qualities too. I mean, he's at least there in the army. He hasn't run away. But why do we know David and we don't know Eliab? Eliab didn't do anything. He didn't have enough courage to do anything. David's a hero. And so our kids know about him. We want them to know about him. We want them to know about this little boy who put his trust in God and God was with him. 5 minutes? Thank you, sir. I want my boys to have those heroes too, but not just the ones they read about in the Bible. Those are important. But I want my boys to have those real life heroes. Those men and women in their church and in their family, they can look at and say, you know what? They put their trust in God too. They put their trust in God when they were sick and they never wavered. They put their trust in God when they had economic hardships and they didn't let it get them down. They put their trust in God when they had tragedy in their family. They put their trust in God when they went through a pandemic. They put their trust in God in every situation I've ever seen them. And God was with them. I want my kids to have a lot of Davids in their life. Eliabs can be fine. But you don't remember Eliab. You remember David. All right. I'm done. Thank you, everyone, for your very, very kind attention. I'll let Jonathan have whatever it is I just dropped.
Just wanted to say thank you so much for your great lesson, Josh. What a wonderful point he made. Of all the many points that he made.
What a wonderful point about how we should not be teaching our kids to give into fear, but tell them about God. The big guy God is. Thank you for that.